The reading this morning comes from the book of Psalms, Psalm 77, verses 1 to 2 and 11 to 20. You have redeemed your people. I cry aloud to God that he may hear me. In the day of my trouble, I seek the Lord. In the night, my hand is stretched out without wearying. My soul refuses to be comforted. I will call to mind the deeds of the Lord. I will remember your wonders of old. I will meditate on all your work and muse on your mighty deeds. Your way, O God, is holy. What God is so great as our God? You are the God who works wonders. You have displayed your might among the peoples. With your strong arm, you redeemed your people, the descendants of Jacob and Joseph. Selah. When the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid. The very deep trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies thundered. Your arrows flashed on every side. The crash of your thunder was in the whirlwind. Your lightnings lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was through the sea, your path through the mighty waters, yet your footprints were unseen. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. Amen.
Thanks, Judy. It's always a great privilege to be asked to bring a message to a church gathering, to a service of worship. So the first thing I ask after sorting out the dates is whether the church is following a particular theme or there's a specific passage to which they would like me to speak. Now here at Park Road, at my home church right now, I know that we're in the middle of a series of looking at the life of Jacob, as described in the book of Genesis. But Derek, I think, has got that mapped out. it looks quizzically. So I didn't want to follow on from that. I'm sure he's going to pick up again next week or soon. I'm not going to do that. Elsewhere, you sometimes know that you've been asked to speak because they've got a hole in their calendar and they just need somebody, and frankly anybody would do. In that kind of situation, that you know that the response to the question will be, you can choose what you want to speak about. In some senses, that actually makes it quite difficult. Unless there's a topic that is particularly burning my heart, how do I know what God would have me speak about? Well, the first thing that I do is turn to a lectionary. Good word. The lectionary is a table of Bible readings which runs typically over 3 years. The Anglicans, the Catholics, and many nonconformist churches have all got lectionaries. They're more or less the same. They're little tweaks here and there with different passages. But for each week of the year, there'll be something from the Old Testament, something from the Psalms, the Gospels, and the rest of the New Testament. The point of the lectionary is that it gives readings that support the church calendar. I'm sure that we all know that the church calendar does not start at the beginning of January, but in fact at the beginning of December with Advent. So there's a cycle of readings for the Advent, Christmas, Epiphany season, last several weeks. And it's the first big event in the Christian year. And then there's a cycle of readings for the Lent, Holy Week, Easter, Ascension, and Pentecost season. And then once the excitement and all the frantic activity that surrounds those two seasons, all of that is complete, the church sort of calms down and goes into what is delightfully called ordinary time, which is about 6 months long. And it starts on Trinity Sunday. You'll remember a couple of weeks ago, Shugufta reminded us that that day was Trinity Sunday, the 15th of June. So today we are in the second Sunday on the second Sunday after Trinity. And the Bible passage that Julie read for us is the psalm set for this day in the lectionary. And as I read Psalm 77, the message that I seemed to hear was something along these lines. It's not about the exciting moments of life where God makes a difference, but it's in the ordinary time that we experience God's constancy in our lives. And so I thought that we might spend our time this morning looking around and thinking about Psalm 77 and what it's saying to us. We often think of the Psalms, we often say, you know, they're King David's Psalms. In actual fact, David only wrote around half of the 150 Psalms that we have in our Bible. Psalm 77 was not written by David, it was written by a notable worship leader called Asaph. We know that he was the chief musician and that he was also a seer and a prophet. He was from the tribe of Levi, and the Levites traditionally undertook many of the tasks which today in traditional Baptist thinking we might think of as work being done by deacons. And from a reference in 2 Chronicles, I think it could reasonably be said that Asaph was held in particularly high regard for the quality of his worship songs. Much as today, many of us appreciate the work of people like Matt Redman, 10,000 Reasons, bless the Lord, or Graham Kendrick. And we're going to end our service with a Graham Kendrick song. And the Psalms were intended to be sung rather than read. I suppose it's because so often we find it easier to remember words we sing. I find it amazing that contemporaries of mine can recite whole songs. You know, sort of Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys died the other day. People I know who can tell you the whole of, Surfing USA and all of those Beach Boys songs. We remember things that we sing more easily than the things that we read. And in Bible times, not everybody would have been able to read. So if we take the psalm as a whole, it falls linguistically into two halves, rather neatly. Two halves make a whole. Verses 1 to 10, and then verses 11 to 20. But if you read the details in this morning's service sheet, or if you noticed the little verse numbers against the reading that Julie read, you'll see that we went from verse 2 to verse 11. I don't know why the editors of the lectionary left out those verses. I've got no idea, but they chose to not include them. So let's take a look at the opening verse. I cry aloud to God, that he may hear me. Somehow you just know that this is not going to be a cry of ecstasy, but a cry of anguish, a cry of desperation. You can tell the difference. You saw that in those pictures of bridges and trains, we actually went across the bridge, not only on my buggy, but on a train as well. And we were going back to the village where we were staying on the train, and a little family got onto the train, and the child wanted to be fed. And its cry told you it was hungry. You knew exactly what the situation was. And this opening verse tells you where the writer is. I cry aloud to God, aloud that he may hear me. This is a cry of desperation, a lament. I don't think we give much thought to such expressions, but we ought to. The lament genre in the Bible is a deeply emotional and a spiritual one. It's a form of writing that expresses sorrow, grief, and a longing for God's intervention, really, during times of suffering. We find such writing throughout the Old and the New Testament, but especially so in Psalms, in Lamentations, and in parts of the prophets. Lament literature gives voice not just to personal, but also to communal pain. It's when the whole group is suffering. But in that lament, in that cry of anguish, there's also the maintenance of a foundation of faith. Biblical laments typically follow a recognizable structure. There's a cry to God, a description of distress, a plea for help, and often a statement of trust or praise, even in the midst of the anguish. I mean, we're talking about Psalms. Psalm 13 opens with the haunting question, "How long, O Lord?" A phrase that reflects both, I think, despair and persistent faith. And you can imagine that believers around the world can use that phrase, "How long, O Lord?" I bet believers in Ukraine are saying, "How long, O Lord?" Believers in Sudan are saying, "How long, O Lord?" Believers in Gaza are saying, "How long, O Lord?" If you want to read the lament genre at full stretch, the fully leaded version, try the Book of Lamentations. It's traditionally attributed to the prophet Jeremiah. And in it, the writer mourns the destruction of the temple about 600 years before Christ. It blends graphic descriptions of suffering with confessions of sin and wrongdoing and affirmations of God's mercy, such as the well-known line, "Great is your faithfulness," which we see in Lamentations 3:23. But the writing also has a poetic quality about it, as in the very first verse of Lamentations, in that very first verse of Lamentations, "How deserted lies the city, once so full of people. How like a widow is she, who once was great among the nations. She who was queen among the provinces has now become a slave." I think what makes the lament genre so powerful is its honesty. These writings, they don't shy away from expressing doubt, fear, or even anger towards God. These emotions are ones that many of us are taught to, or perhaps encouraged to hide, especially if we come from nice, comfortable, middle-class Christian families. And yet they can also shape a relationship with God that is intimate and unafraid to question. God is big enough to handle such behavior on our part. We can be angry at the way things turn out, and we can tell him so. And I can assure you from personal experience that it doesn't make him turn away from interacting with us. Laments remind us that grief and faith can coexist. Somehow it offers us a sacred space where we can cope with trauma while still hoping for redemption. And in this way, lament becomes not just a complaint, but a form of worship, a form of spiritual resilience. Our passage from Psalm 77 opens with that cry to God and then goes on to seek help. "In the day of my trouble, I seek the Lord. In the night, my hand is stretched out without weary. My soul refuses to be comforted." But we then move on from the cry of distress to remembrance of better times. I will call to mind the deeds of the Lord. I will remember your wonders of old. Verses 11 to 15 highlight the power of remembering God's past goodness as a source of hope in the midst of distress. Maybe it's not an event. Maybe it's a place. As I said, we were in Wales, and as we drove across to the west coast of Wales, we were just once again reminded of the beauty of God's creation. There is something about the open skies of Fenland, but there's something more about the hills of Wales, and I'm sure Derek and Carol enjoyed the highlands of Scotland. And you know, we'll perhaps all have a place where we see God's beauty, reminding us of the power of creation. But in this passage in the psalm, Asaph the writer shifts from despair to reflection. And this act of remembrance becomes a turning point, moving the psalm from lament to renewed confidence in God's goodness and faithfulness. Asaph is deliberately recalling God's mighty works, his wonders, strength, and redemption. And by focusing on what God has done in the past, particularly his deliverance of Israel, we see Asaph basing his present faith in historical reality. And this is especially significant because the psalm begins with that deep anguish. Sometimes we think, you know, sort of, why me? And a sense of God being distant or silent. And this shift to memory reminds us that feelings of abandonment are not the whole story. God has acted before, and he can act again. Verses 13 to 15 emphasizes God's holiness and power. Your way, O God, is holy. What God is so great as our God? This declaration affirms not only God's uniqueness, but also his track record of saving his people with power and compassion. Not necessarily by removing them from scenes of trauma or carnage, but often by that sense of peace, by the giving of serenity and fortitude. The reference to redemption, particularly in verse 15, with your mighty arm you renewed your people, in all probability alludes to the Exodus, you know, a central act of divine salvation where God rescued his people from slavery. So these verses 11 to 15 shows us how remembering God's past faithfulness reorientates our soul, turning despair into worship, anxiety into trust. I think it invites us as believers to draw strength from God's unchanging character and God's mighty acts. And then comes an interesting word in the text that Julie did read for us, Selah. Now you might think, why didn't the translators put that into English? Well, it's not translated because translators are not sure precisely what it means. But a strong contender is that, I said earlier on that Psalms were written to be sung. So a strong contender is that Selah is a musical term, meaning something like, well, we've come to a hinge point in the song, so we're going to take a little break from singing. We're going to have a little 8-bar riff. Just to sort of move us from that thought to this. We're going to go in a fresh direction. Because the final five verses of the psalm have a very different feel. Verses 16 to 18 are rich in symbolism. They're drawing from natural imagery to depict God's majestic power and his divine intervention. The waters of verse 16 symbolize chaos. I said about the speed at which the River Maud in West Wales flows. And as I was going across the bridge, and I could see the water going, and I'm just thinking, you know, on the face of it, this just looks like a body of water, but you realize that if you fell into it, you would be swept downstream or upstream. You would have no chance of making it to the banks of the river. The waters symbolize chaos, danger, and overwhelming obstacles. In ancient Hebrew thought, the sea often represented forces of disorder. And when the psalmist says the waters saw God and were afraid, he's personifying nature as recognizing and submitting to the Creator's authority. I think this conveys the fact that even the most uncontrollable of forces, like the sea, must bow to God's will. And this is a thought that's picked up in the New Testament, when we read, for example, of Jesus calming the storm, an incident that is so important in the minds of the writers that it's mentioned in all three of the Synoptic Gospels, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. The thunder, lightning, the arrows, if you like, storm clouds and earthquakes in verses 17 and 18 emphasize divine judgment, power, and presence. These images are not just literal, but they're symbolic of God's ability to shake the natural and the spiritual realms. And God's thunder in the whirlwind, great phrase, may also symbolize how his ways are mysterious and beyond human understanding. Sometimes we think, you know, so God, how are you working in this situation? You want to read that? Go and have a look at Job. Job 38. You know, I don't understand what you're doing, God. The mysteries of God. The lightnings in this verse illuminating the world and suggest sudden revelation. Moments when God's glory pierces the human darkness that we so often experience. So overall, these verses powerfully symbolize God as sovereign over creation, mighty in deliverance, and fearsome in holiness. For the psalmist, and for us as readers, they serve as a reminder that no matter how chaotic life becomes, the one who commands the storm is present and is in control and is worthy of awe. And so we come to the last two verses. And surely these do symbolize God's mysterious guidance and his faithful leadership, especially during times of crisis. Your way was through the sea. Recalls the parting of the Red Sea, where God made a path where none existed. The footprints were unseen. It emphasizes God's invisible presence, though his actions are evident. That last picture I showed you in that little quiz we had was about a causeway. If ever the path is revealed, but the footsteps become unseen, isn't a causeway a brilliant demonstration of that? God's methods often remain hidden. They require trust. They require faith. And finally, the imagery in this psalm of leading like a flock evokes God's role as a shepherd, guiding his people with care and with intention. Verse 20, you led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. Draws us back to verse 15. You redeemed your people, the descendants of Jacob and Joseph, and grounds the symbolism in historical reality, showing how God works through human leaders, and ties us neatly into the sermon series that we're currently going through with Jacob. Together, I think, these final verses portray God as both transcendent and near, mysterious yet intimately involved, reminding us that even when his presence is not visible, he is actively guiding his people with purpose and with compassion. Earlier on this morning, we looked at the ingenious engineering constructions that we call bridges. We reminded ourselves that the literal word bridge doesn't appear in the Bible translations that most of us use. In fact, I couldn't find a Bible translation, but I'm sure somebody might somewhere might be able to come up with one that's got the word bridge in it somewhere. But most of us, NIV, RSV, King James, whichever version we use, does not have the word bridge. Nevertheless, the concept of bridges carries deep symbolic significance, representing connection, change, travel. And this psalm richly, I think, embodies those notions and helps us move from the frailty of our human condition to the security of God's way. Asaph and the people of Old Testament times did not have the benefit of knowing that God could dwell among them and become the covering, the sacrifice for their wrongdoing. We know that Jesus, God in human form, spans the gap caused by sin, bridges that awful chasm, allowing us to make a new connection with heaven. We know that Jesus can help us experience change, from bondage to freedom, from death to life, from fear to faith. We know that Jesus opens up new paths for us to travel. The Israelites crossing the Red Sea and later the Jordan River are powerful images of God opening a path where there was none, bridging his people into new seasons of promise. So let's take away from our look at Psalm 77 this morning some straightforward messages. Do not be afraid of expressing your emotions to God. I cry aloud to God. Remember all the works of God. I will call to mind the deeds of the Lord. Anticipate God's leading to be surprising. Your way was through the sea, yet your footprints were unseen. May God bless his word to us and enrich our understanding. So now let us go forth into the world to serve. Let us go in peace. Be of good courage. Hold fast to that which is good. Render to no one evil for evil. Strengthen the faint-hearted. Support the weak. Help the afflicted. Honor all people, love and serve the Lord, rejoicing in the power of the Holy Spirit. Amen.